Hey, everybody, this is Robbie Robinson with Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. And you are listening, my friends, to the Robert Miller Follow Your Dream podcast. Oh, what a podcast.
Everyone has a dream. Robert Miller is a musician who had a dream to become a rock star. He followed his dream and he succeeded. If you're ready to pursue and succeed at your dream, then listen up and get inspired and motivated to take action today. Welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the award-winning Follow Your Dream podcast with listeners worldwide in 200 countries. I'm Robert Miller, your host. My guest today is Lee Shapiro, who's had an absolutely incredible career in music. He was the longtime keyboardist and musical director for Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. He was the arranger on two of their biggest hits, December 1963, Oh What a Night, and Who Loves You. He went on to another career creating music for commercials for Budweiser, Coke, and others. He also collaborated with Barry Manilow on Copacabana, the musical. And he created Rock and Roll Elmo, a toy for Fisher-Price. And last but not least, he formed The Hitmen, a classic rock tribute band. And in the middle of this episode, as I do with all my musician guests, Lee and I are going to do a song fest. I've asked him to give me a handful of his best works, and we'll play a little bit. We'll talk about them. You'll get the backstories, and nobody else does this in podcasts. And my featured song in this episode, underneath the introduction and at the end, is You Really Got Me by the Kinks. Why? Well, Lee founded the Hitmen, who play iconic cover songs. I call my song a reimagined version of the Kinks classic, but we're definitely in the same neighborhood. So Lee Shapiro, welcome to the Follow Your Dream podcast, baby.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, I got to start off. Sometimes I pick things out of people's bios or resumes that just hit me. And I'm saying to myself as I'm reading your bio, you went from the Four Seasons to Elmo. Okay, that was quite a jump. Tell me how and why you made that kind of a jump. And then we're going to go back, of course, and talk about the Four Seasons.
Sounds great. Well, I'll tell you, the Four Seasons happened in the 70s, and I was lucky enough to be there. I replaced Bob Gaudio and went on to have all those hit records until about 1980. Just to kind of fill in some of the gaps, in 1981, I was a Shondell for 2 years because I had left Frankie and I was doing my own thing. And you know as well as I do, when you're trying to become a producer or whatever the next phase is, it doesn't happen just because you decide. So while I'm working on it, I got together with Tommy James and I did 2 years of Shondelling. And then after that, I opened a jingle company in the city and was doing music for television, as you mentioned. And in that time, in doing those commercials, I'm looking at Fisher-Price, which was a jingle client of mine. And I said to my partner at the time, do you think this is fun? And they said, no. So what hasn't been done? This is 23 years ago now. They had Tickle Me Elmo. We came up with Rock and Roll Elmo.
Hey, rock the house, Elmo.
Easy as 1, 2, 3.
And now kids can jam right along with their very own rock and roll guitar. It's totally awesome at Sesame Street.
And everybody in the world said, oh, man, you can't just go to Fisher-Price and you can't just sit down and everybody was full of why we couldn't do this. You're working for them as a jingle company. That's, you know, collusion. You get, I don't care about that stuff.
So you had the idea. You didn't actually have the product, I assume.
No, I drew a picture. And then I had my wife and I make a prototype. We bought an Elmo. We dressed him up like a rock and roll star. We put music in the witch that's in Halloween that shakes and cackles.
Right.
I took that mechanism out of the witch, cut the speakers and stuck him in Elmo so he shook when he played. You know, all this is just happening out of sheer desire and intent with no understanding of how that inventing business works. But I knew the people. So we made this prototype and we went in and we had a meeting and they took it and it sold 4 million pieces worldwide, bigger than my whole career with the Seasons and everything.
All right, stop right there. You know how crazy that story is that you just told.
Yes.
Because there are people that line up every day to ask places like Fisher Price, I got an idea, I got a prototype, please run with it. And they tell them to go fish. And you hit the big time. Unbelievable.
Well, it was a different world, too. Frankly, today you can't do what I did, which was have a concept, make a prototype, go in and have a face-to-face wonderful meeting with the director of inventor development, and then does something, and then he says, how about this? And before you know it, they own it, and it's fabulous. Today, the same industry, and I'm still doing things, not nearly to that magnitude, but today, basically, you do everything. Animation, prototype, whatever it is, and you make a video of it and you send it through the Fisher Price portal and they accept it and acknowledge receipt. And that's the end of it. They take it or they don't take it, yes or no. It's, you know, it's the same as the record industry in that there used to be development money.
Right.
Now, basically, what record company in their right mind would sign an unknown when they could sign someone who came in fourth place on American Idol? Because 20 million people have seen that guy who lost, which is a built-in fan base.
You know, what I loved about the old days in the record business, I actually owned a label for a period of time. And back then, there were gatekeepers, okay, that decided what would move forward within the process. And for the most part, I think that was good because they weeded out all the junk. But at the end of the day, what did record labels do? They took the song or the album and figuratively threw it against the wall. And if it stuck, they chased it. And if it didn't stick, they just let it go. And you're right. Now it's different because with social media, there's all this built-in audience stuff. And, you know, the interesting thing is nobody goes and pitches anymore on the basis of the quality of the music. It's always on the basis of how many followers do we have?
What word did you just use with the Q?
Quality.
Oh, I remember that.
Remember that? There was a time when that made a difference.
I have to tell you something. And I said this to Frankie Valli in the 70s because I wanted to produce his brother, Bobby. And Frankie wasn't into it. They had a family rivalry, whatever it was. But the truth of the matter is if the record companies back then, and if any distributor of any product, could sell an empty box and make the same money, they would. If they could have sold blank vinyl in the 70s, they would have. And now the entire industry, as you well know, has kind of funneled down into live performances, the only place to make money, unless you're Ed Sheeran or, you know, Taylor Swift. Other than that, I mean, it used to be you could have a little hit and make some money, you go on a little tour. It just is the only money to be had. You can, selling recordings, you're getting a tenth of a cent per stream, and who knows where it's streaming. And there, nobody's buying albums per se, and you're not getting the royalty that we used to get when we had a hit. And so what's happening is that, and this is very true of The Voice and Idol and X Factor, all that stuff, America's Got Talent. If you pass the audition, you sign away everything. You sign away performance, licensing, your likeness, the music, because they know that there's nowhere to go, that all the money is going to be made in live performance. In other words, selling merchandise, getting concerts, doing appearances. Maybe you'll get on TV or what used to be TV, Netflix or whatever. And they know that that's where the money is and they want that.
You know, the old version of all of this was when all the groups in the 60s, the Beatles included, signed away all their publishing rights because that was simply a condition to getting signed.
And no one knew.
Right. Who knew that these things were going to last for 50 or 60 years?
Who knew that out of every dollar, the publisher was getting 50 cents? He didn't even know that.
I've told this little story a few times on the podcast, but it's germane to what we're saying now. I interviewed John Lodge from the Moody Blues. And when he was 19 years old, he went to his friends and he said, you know, I'm going to be a musician. And they all said to him, gee, that's great. What are you going to do when you're 21? Okay, because there was no such thing as a career in music at that time. Nobody had the slightest idea that these songs were going to last 50, 60 years, and they were going to be worth a fortune. Only a small handful of artists kept their rights. I think that Chuck Berry was actually one of those.
I worked with Chuck a number of times, and I actually shook his hand a few times and hung out. It was amazing. I couldn't have been more than 22 or 3. And I was doing the Sonny and Cher show with Frankie, and Chuck was on it. And I got to talk to him. I ran into him again, completely coincidentally, in Wolverhampton, England. I walked into a diner, and there he was. And I went over, and he remembered me. It was quite lovely. But I will tell you, to embellish your story a little further, we're doing the Sonny and Cher show, and Frankie says to me, you know, Chuck doesn't work unless he gets the cash in his pocket. I said, come on. He said, watch for him. So I watched for him. Frankie knew him forever.
Right.
And he walked in here he is, Chuck Berry, the father of rock and roll. He walks into the studio with his guitar case and nobody else, just him.
Right.
Got out of his car with the case, no manager, no handler, no nothing. He walks onto the set in the clothes he showed up in. He opens his guitar. He goes, are we ready? I say, yeah. He starts playing. He doesn't count it off. He starts playing Maybelline. The band, if they don't jump in, they're off. They're off the gig. In other words, if you don't know my songs from Chuck Berry's standpoint, then I don't want you to play. Meanwhile, I looked in his pocket, and there was a square outline on his polyester white pants, and it was 10 grand in cash on camera.
Unbelievable. You know, it's funny you say this, because I remember I saw Chuck Berry for the first time when I was in college. This is late 60s. And exactly like you said, he came to the venue. It was a gymnasium that he was playing in. There was a pickup band on the stage. I don't think they had ever met him before.
I'm sure not, yeah.
And he walked up on the stage, took his guitar out, and just started playing. Okay? It's exactly right.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, they talk about today as far as taking care of your body and health. And I got to meet so many people. I mean, like Frankie Valli is going to be 90 this year. I know what we did on the road. Chuck Berry is Chuck Berry. Fats Domino is another guy I ended up meeting and working with. All of these people from the 60s and on into the 70s, even more so. Keith Richard. These people are a million years old. They never did a sit-up in their life. They don't know what a carrot juice is. You know, and yet, you know, I'm starting to feel, honestly, that anything that can be turned into an industry could be marketed any way you want it, at least at first.
It's interesting that you mentioned Keith Richard, because I always like to say about him that he's a walking testament to the immune system, okay? Because there's no way that this guy should be alive.
Absolutely. And it's not because he was a smoker, which, of course, he still is at 81. But the heroin usage, and, you know, he made my rock and roll habits look like I was having a donut and coffee. You know what I mean? It's just,
there you go.
But first of all, also, you know as well as I do, in the 60s and the late 60s, early 70s, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. If you signed in for one, you were on for all of them. And no one had any idea what they were doing to themselves health-wise. Cigarettes were all, I mean, look at the Tonight Show from the late 60s and early 70s.
Right, Johnny Carson sitting there smoking a cigarette. You're right about that.
Yeah.
All right, let's go back. I want to get into the Four Seasons part of your career, because they were one of the most iconic acts in the history of music. I've been so fortunate to have a couple of other people that have been connected with Frankie and the Four Seasons. I had some songwriters, L. Russell Brown, Sandy Linzer.
I spoke to him yesterday.
There you go. I had Robbie Robinson, who is the current musical director on the show.
Let me interject. I hired Robbie to be background keyboard player in 78. He's still there.
Okay. I'm going to tell him that too.
Yeah, please. I talk to him all the time too.
Terrific. All right. So tell me, how did you get with Frankie? Go back to that era.
You're going to love this. I'm 19 years old. No, actually, I was 18 at the time, and I needed to make extra money. I was going to Manhattan School of Music as a composition major and a piano major. I'm playing on Monday nights with a big band because that was my love, like Buddy Rich and Count Basie. And I just loved that stuff as a kid.
Hold on 1 second. Let me stop you for 1 second. We were just talking about Chuck Berry running up on the stage, taking his guitar out and playing. Tell me that you didn't see Buddy Rich do something like that all the time. He'd be on The Tonight Show talking to Johnny Carson. And all of a sudden, Johnny would say, hey, buddy, you want to play a number for us? He'd walk over to the drums without any rehearsal, without anything. Boom. Just hit it completely.
It was a genius.
Yes, a total genius. Anyway, I interrupted you. Please go back.
That's not a problem. So any case, I take a gig. And I wanted to be an orchestrator. I knew that because of the sound of the horns and the strings, all that captivated me. Everything from Henry Mancini to Stan Kenton. You know, I was just, and the Beatles, of course. Because I think I was 9 or 10 when they came out. But in any case, the situation was I'm playing in Garfield, New Jersey at the Down Under Lounge. And everybody's making $20 a night at a 17-piece big band. And I'm writing charts. And it's costing me $20 a night because I'm paying to get the music copied. Anyway, Gaudio is at the point in his career, and this is 1972 maybe, where he wants to leave. I'm not finding all this, you know, in retrospect. So turns out I get a phone call from the then bass player who replaced Nick Massey in the 60s, Joe Long. And Joe says, our manager happened to go to the Down Under Lounge on the referral of a guy named Lou Toby, who was a local arranger and producer who I had worked with and was friends with Frankie. His real name was Tabanini, who knows what it was, but he was definitely up there. And he said, you got to go see this kid at the Down Under Lounge, blah, blah, blah. And he had, so I get a phone call and Joe says to me, so we saw you, would you be willing to come down and do an audition? So I do. Now they were so broke, just like is depicted in Jersey Boys. They were $4 million in debt because of Tommy DeVito and Nick Massey's antics. And we were rehearsing in the Fountain Restaurant's banquet room in Belleville, New Jersey. Didn't have the money for a rehearsal facility. So they had friends there. And I walk in and I start to rehearse. And Frankie walks in because it's late. He's the featured star. And they put music in front of me and he says, play this. And it's Dawn, which, as it turns out, I become friends with Sandy Linzer, who wrote Dawn with Gaudio.
Right.
And I play the first chord. Now, again, I'm just a late teenager. I'm like 19. And Frankie is 39, 20 years my senior. And I play Bloom. And he goes, pretty as a midsummer morn.
Pretty as a midsummer's morn. They called her
Now, granted, I wasn't a fan per se, but I was enamored that he was the real guy. And I stopped playing. He said, what's the matter? I said, man, you sound just like on the radio. And they all had a big laugh at my expense. Anyway, the next day after that rehearsal, I got a call again from Joe. And he says, we want you to come on board. And this is what we pay. Are you ready? We pay gross $350 a week. So I played, my first gig was up in the lounge in the Flamingo opposite Fats Domino, playing 53 shows in a month, sometimes four a night. And at the end of the month, my take home was $960 for a month.
Oh, man. That's the music business. Everybody loves it, huh?
Well, you know what? Honestly, to your point, I brought my contract when it was finally time and I had done Who Loves You. And it was my very first hit record. I wrote the strings for it when I was like, it was 75, so I was 22. I just couldn't believe I found myself in a room, a real studio room with, you know, like not my little four track, but like it was real. There was all, it had 18 strings in front of me, all that stuff.
And listen, the Four Seasons were at the top of the game, okay?
This was the entree back in. I'll tell you, I don't know how many people know it, but I know it for a fact. they couldn't get a record deal, the Four Seasons. They had left Mo West, which was a division of Motown who did nothing for them at all and really wasted a lot of good masters, in my opinion. But they went to Warner's Curb. Mike Curb, the lieutenant governor at the time, had a record label. And they went to him, and they took a four-point deal. This is the Four Seasons. They had, like, you know, 70 million records sold. And they were given $9,000 for the whole deal. And they had recorded the master. Well, they had to record the master. It was all done. They brought it in, got released. Boom. It went to number one. And then after that, of course, Oh What a Night is in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most times on the charts, most records sold. And that's why, you know, they are today. I'm so independent.
Hi, everybody. This is Robert Miller, your host. You know, one of the many benefits to me of doing this podcast is being able to collaborate musically with some of my guests who are among the best musicians in the world. My first collaboration was with the great Jim Peterik of the Ides of March and formerly with Survivor. Jim and I collaborated on The Fall of Winter, a song about a blue-collar worker who dreams of a better life. Also contributing was Elliot Randall, the renowned guitarist. He pulls his covers over his head. John Helliwell was the amazing saxophonist in Supertramp, one of the greatest bands of the rock era. John collaborated with me on my 2023 album, Bobby M. and the Paisley Parade, and he's featured on several tracks. One of them is This Time. Tony Carey is a singer-songwriter and keyboard genius who played with Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow. Tony has collaborated with me on several recordings, including his exquisite organ playing on All of the Time. I want you. And I've just finished a new collaboration with the brilliant trumpeter Randy Brecker, formerly of Blood, Sweat, and Tears, who plays on my new single, The Rich Ones. Collaborations like these make the podcast very special indeed. As always, thank you for listening and keep on rocking. All right, we got to get into the Songfest portion. You've been talking about Oh What a Night. I'm playing it right now underneath us. Oh What a Night. Late December back in 63. What a very special time for me. As I remember what a night. Oh What a Night. Give me a little bit more background on that one. Tell me the story.
Oh What a Night was originally about 1933 Prohibition. It was a disaster as far as a lyric, we felt. But we already cut the track, and the track was smoking. It was cooking. We had a meeting with Gaudio, and we said, Bobby, actually with the late Don Ciccone, my writing partner, said, I don't like the lyrics. And Gaudio's looking at us, you're talking to me? I have hit records, you know. And he said, let's go around the room. What do you think? What do you think? And I, of course, was a snot-nosed kid. I said, I think it's badly written, Bob. I thought he was going to bust a vein. He was so upset. He was turning purple. And I said, nobody cares about Prohibition. Nobody even knows what it is. He says, well, and he stormed out of the room, and that was the end of that. And the next day, we met again because we were in the middle of making an album. And he, with his then-wife, Judy, rest in peace, had rewritten all the lyrics unbeknownst to us. And it turned out to be the lyrics that are famous for being on the record about a guy's first love experience. And if Don Ciccone hadn't objected to it. And then we went around the room and everybody chimed in that we just think it's bad. It would have never been the hit that it was. And in typical Gaudio fashion, on the second pressing, I got a Ranger credit. And that was that. Not the first pressing, the second pressing.
The second one. Well, listen, for anybody who doesn't know, we've talked about Bob Gaudio before. He was the genius, the musical genius behind the Four Seasons. And we've had on the podcast different stories about the way he controlled and made that group and the sound. So I just wanted to put that in his background.
Well, let me just say this to you. There's two factors of the Four Seasons. I'm sorry. Let me say four factors. This is going to be the definition of the Four Seasons, okay? Frankie Valli's sound, Bob Gaudio's hit writing, Charlie Colello's arranging, and Bob Cruise producing.
Yeah.
Those four names equal the Four Seasons. Now, not to minimize Nick Massey, who had great vocal arranging ideas, and not to minimize Tommy DeVito's, you know, kind of raw street felt way he played because he wasn't educated. But the truth of the matter is, the sound of the Four Seasons is Frankie, Bob, Charlie, and Bob Crewe. And I worked with all of them at like 20. I was on the My Eyes Adore You session.
My eyes adore you. Oh, I never laid a hand on you. My eyes adore you. Like a million miles away from me, you couldn't see how I adored you. So close, so close, and yet so far.
I was on Swearing to God's session.
Swearing to God, there's no one else on earth I'd rather be. Swearing to God, you make me see, so I believe in me.
Even though I didn't have to do anything, I didn't play on Swearing to God, I went over to Denny Randall, who was working with Sandy Windsor, and I passed the music out to the musicians just to be a part of the session. It was so exciting for a kid, not even 20, you know?
Well, they were, as we've said, at the top of the game, okay?
Yes.
They had such a distinctive sound. They had great songs, great recordings, great everything. But something that you just touched upon, Oh What a Night, which was then the next song that you had a big hit with, was December 1963. And both of them, I always felt, they were kind of risque. Okay. It was about people's first experience.
They were.
And yet, you know, even though the radio at that time was very prudish about what got on top 40 radio, these things passed right through and you had gigantic hits.
Well, I'll tell you something. First of all, the people that had the record label were very influential. That's number one. When you have a label that can say, well, we're Warner Brothers, so if you want to have the next release of whatever and have that first on your network of radio stations, then you got to start playing the Four Seasons. That kind of stuff is still in the industry today. You know, I do for you, you do for me. It's the way it worked, but it was even less sophisticated back in the day. As you well know. But what happened was that Gaudio knew that dance music in the 70s was what was going on. If you weren't making dance music, it was very difficult to get in, unless you were a rock band, and the Four Seasons were never known as a metal or a rock band. And he was able to combine a dance track played by a bunch of young guys who made it sound like the 70s and then put that Seasons vocal thing on top of it.
Right.
Which, frankly, Gaudio was great at, but also learned the Four Seasons sound that existed before he even got there, because he learned it listening to what they were doing with My Mother's Eyes.
One bright and guiding light that taught me wrong from right. I found in Mother's Eye.
You know, all the, before there were hits that Nick Massey had done the vocal parts for. And again, I to keep reverting it back to my experiences, I don't mean to do that so regularly, but I stood in the studio with Frankie, Bob Gaudio, Joe Long and Nick Massey, and I'm singing. And the way they did it is you stood in a circle at Media Sound in New York, which used to be a church. And we're all standing in a circle, and I'm not a great singer, but I could sing background. And I must have been flat. And Nick Massey reaches his finger out like this, you know, like this kind of thing under your chin. And he goes like this to me.
He raises it up, huh?
And I looked at Frankie, and he said, "You're flat." That's how Nick Massey told you that you're singing flat. You gotta get a little higher.
Get it up a little bit.
I don't want to take up the whole lot, but I got such amazing stories with amazing people. If I never made a nickel, the stories themselves are wealth.
Well, I love this kind of stuff, and we do a lot of this on the podcast, and you've been great. But I want to go on to these couple of other things that you've done. Tell me about this Barry Manilow experience with Copacabana the musical.
You won't believe when I tell you what it is. I did some demos for Barry in my jingle years when I was in someone else's jingle house and I had a room and I was paying rent and I did some work there. And he knew me from when I met him when I was with Frank briefly. Hello. You know. So they're coming to New York and they're looking someone to make the tracks, but they don't want to spend a lot of money because when they do the master, then they're going to have a real orchestra. And Synclavier, which was the first polyphonic sampling synthesizer of the day, I had one. It was very expensive, but I knew that was what was coming. And if you wanted to play the piano, you'd end up in a restaurant. So I got this instrument, and this is the best. I moved from the studio that I was in to my own facility. And my wife says to me, my daughter is 39 now. She was like about six at the time. And my wife says to me, "Why don't you call Barry Manilow?" I mean, a total naive, wonderful, uplifting kind of faith comment from her. "And tell him you're in your new place and tell him this." I said, "Sweetheart, we're talking about Barry Manilow. I mean, yes, I did a demo with him, but you think I'm going to call him?" She goes, "Well, write him a letter." Well, she wasn't going to leave me alone with it. I said, "Why are you so insistent?" My wife is part Cherokee Indian, so I don't ever doubt her instincts. And she said to me, "Because I had a dream and Barry was in it." I said, "And that's why you want?" She goes, "Yes." I wrote a letter. I never thought about it again, but I guess a few weeks went by. We go out to dinner. We come back. The babysitter is white as a ghost. She says, "Ask your daughter who called." I said, "Did we get a call tonight, Ariel?" She was about, you know, six or seven. I said, "Who was it?" "Barry Manilow." "So you got to be kidding." She goes, "No, here's the number." I called him back. It was Barry. It was Barry. I said, "Hi, man." He says, "Look, we want to talk about a project we're doing. It's called Copacabana the Musical. It's good, this, that, and the other thing. We'd like to fly you out for the day. Have a production." I mean, there was no Zoom. "So have a production meeting, and then we'll fly you back." So I said, "Okay." They flew me out first class, and we had a meeting in a room. Barry walked in, his manager, his manager, who is now his husband, you know, publicly known, which I'm grateful for. That's where we are today, at least with that. I wish it was even better, but be that as it may. I went and we met, and he flew me back home, and I got the job. Now, mind you, this is 1990, and I'm not saying this to impress you with money, but I was earning my way back into an industry, the jingle business, TV music, and it came to $100,000 worth of work on my brand new studio that I just opened, and I developed a friendship with the man. And he said to me on the first day, "Lee, there's a point in the show when a helicopter is going to come in. And do you have the capacity other than music?" So as he's talking, I can call up with my computer early in the day, you know, dot matrix printers, monochrome monitors, green with a little yellow. And I call up the sound of a helicopter. I go, "You mean like this?" And it pans across the speakers. Chicka, 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 chicka. And I had the gig. That was the end of that.
The helicopter got you the gig. I love that.
The helicopter got me the gig. Absolutely true. But he's a very gifted man for what it's worth. If he never sang a note ever, he would be a huge wealthy man, because two of the three commercials that he wrote back in his pre-Bette Midler days still run. Like a Good Neighbor, State Farm is there. He wrote,
"Like a Good Neighbor, State Farm is there."
And McDonald's commercials.
These are our rate today. So get up and get away to McDonald's.
Isn't it amazing how these things have a life that just goes on and on?
60 years of residuals. You know, I mean, it's honestly, there's so many things like that. I always liken it to Paul McCartney. If the only thing he did in his entire life was write Yesterday, he'd have been fine.
I think he might have made a few shekels from that.
Yeah, so he's made 100,000 times those shekels. Anyway, man, it's great to talk to someone like you who's knowledgeable, has a background, and also still gets a kick out of it like I do.
I certainly do. We've been speaking here with Lee Shapiro, the incredible Lee Shapiro. You've got so many stories. We'll have to do a part two at some point here.
I love that.
I want to thank you so much for being a guest on this podcast. It's really been fantastic.
My pleasure, man. Continued success with it. You're the right guy to do this.
I appreciate that. We're going to listen now to that song that started off the podcast. It's my reimagined version of the Kinks classic, You Really Got Me. And I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Follow Your Dream podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss another inspiring episode. You can connect with Robert at robert@followyourdreampodcast.com. And you can hear more from his band at projectgrandslam.com. Set me free. I always wanna be by your side.